This segment of the Chris and Amy Show is brought to you by Eggnog Unlimited. Because your cup should always run up over.
Wait, it's Luigi.
This is wild.
Yeah, it's Luigi.
Guys, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life.
I know.
See him in the orange jumpsuit?
Oh, he's in the orange jumpsuit. Oh my God.
You're doing great, baby.
Oh, we love you, Luigi. No.
Well, that's a bunch of people in an office building in New York looking out as the helicopter extradited Luigi Mangione from Philadelphia or from Pennsylvania to New York. I got to tell you something real quick as a sidebar here.
Yeah.
They have just absolutely paraded him out. And I'm talking about the authorities.
Yeah.
They have paraded him out and they have created this whole thing.
Yeah.
Or they've helped exacerbate it, I would say.
The mayor was walking with him.
Yeah.
I don't understand that.
They've made it look like such a, I don't know, they are helping turn him into an idol. That seems to be what's happening. We go to the Quiver River Electric guest line because Luigi Mangione, the person who is being charged with killing the CEO of United Healthcare. We are talking now with Thane Rosenbaum, who is our CBS legal analyst on the Quiver River Electric guest line. Thane, good to talk to you. How are you?
Very well, Chris and Amy. Happy holidays to the both of you.
Same to you.
Me
it's
too.
Good to have you with us. So, a big step today moving forward in the process of going after Luigi Mangione.
You know, it's interesting what you started off with, the perp walk, right? Is what they call that parade. You know, in France, that's illegal. Can't do that. Yeah, there's some countries that just say, if you mean innocent until proven guilty, then that's what you mean. And we will not let you parade people around in order to prejudice the jury pool and to humiliate them and deprive them of human dignity. You may hate this guy. You may think he's a murderer. He's not entitled to human dignity. But the French take that very seriously, that is not a dignified way for him to be processed through the system. Yes, today it's just processing.
They perp walked him again today, too, by the way.
Oh, did
they?
No, they're going to do, I love this thing. I didn't even know this. That you're saying the mayor was walking alongside. I mean, that's ridiculous. It's like a campaign poster.
Yeah.
So all I could say is that there's been a number of developments. It seems like everyone wants to get in on the parade. The federal government has now filed its own separate prosecution on federal stalking laws, right? You're going, really? You're going, New York State's got, you know, second degree manslaughter and first degree terrorism charges. And then the federal government wants also a piece of him. So the question is, which of those cases are going to go first? My guess is the state case will go first because it's the more serious of the charges, just like Pennsylvania had charges, right? But they extradited him because New York's charges were more severe. He's finally there. By the way, that's the other thing that happened. You know, normally they don't unseal an indictment until you're standing next to them, standing in front of them. But in this case, everyone unsealed the indictment, even though he wasn't in New York. He was in Pennsylvania, as if to send the message, this is what we're doing and this is what he's done.
With the different charges, the state charges, the federal charges, I believe it's the federal charges that could potentially carry the death sentence, the death penalty for his actions. This is normal how something like this would be prosecuted when it's murder, but also with a terrorism motivation.
Yeah, but you know, again, you know, you wonder in situations like this, Amy, whether this is one of those overcharge cases, right? You think of terrorism, you go 9/11, right?
Yeah.
Is that what we're talking about? And so when that people first started terrorism, I don't even know if this plays into his fandom, right? They're charging him with terrorism. He's a hero, right? So, you know, it's one thing to say he committed second degree murder. We saw what he did. You know, there's all kinds of circumstantial evidence. There's DNA all over the place. But once you introduce these other more, you know, esoteric, complicated things that we don't associate with this kind of a crime, you wonder whether two things in overcharging, will that hurt them or does it help them? Because sometimes if you overcharge, it's what happened with the Daniel Penny case. If the jury can't reach a verdict on the highest charge, the prosecution goes, okay, forget that. Let's go back to the second charge in order to try to guarantee the second one. That didn't happen in the Daniel Penny case here. That's the subway strangling strangler case. But that, you know, is part of the strategy, the motivation of prosecutors sometimes to overcharge on the theory that we'll overcharge, the jury won't pick this crime, but they'll definitely put him in prison for 25 years under the second charge.
Is that why they will do a first degree murder and then a second degree murder? Because I'm it happens a lot, I'm told, yeah. But I've never really noticed it, I guess, because it always seems to me that it would be one or the other.
Yeah, no, it is. They do that to cover all their bases, to say, look, we don't really fully understand what evidence will come out of trial. And let's make sure that whatever evidence comes up is covered under the elements of each crime. So, you know, look, prosecutors, one thing is true. Prosecutors do not like to be humiliated. They do not like to bring cases that blow up in their faces. When it came to Donald Trump, it was a little different because there was just a lot of appeal to charge him. It was everyone wanted to charge him. Who was first out of the gate? Who could prosecute him? But generally speaking, prosecutors, you know, try not to overcharge because if it blows up in their face, they're embarrassed. And that goes to the point of why would they create all these other additional charges is to make sure it's not a full acquittal, that something he eventually becomes guilty of.
Thane, I don't know what to make of the jury that will be, well, determining this case, because I'm seeing that Luigi Mangione's lawyer is worried that he won't get a fair trial. But I've also heard people speculate that Luigi Mangione has so much sympathy and support that the outcry has been really bizarre publicly, that there could be a jury that is sympathetic to his cause. Which way do you see, which side is the bigger problem for the prosecutor and the defense in this case?
Well, Amy, you know, all you need is one person on the jury who says, I don't see it. And and you've got a hung jury, it's a deadlock, right? So you really have to say, of the 12 jurors, might there be one person who hates corporate America, period. They hate everyone that's involved with corporations. They don't trust anything. Or they, believe me, during the voir dire, they're going to say, has any one of your family member ever had a serious disease that was declined by the insurance company? Right. That's going to be a huge voir dire question to know. Are you secretly also hating on the medical industry because we don't trust you? Because this guy's going to become a folk hero on how he, you know, send the message. By the way, that's the whole point of the terrorism. You might go, why is that like 9/11? Well, it's not. But it's a different way of looking at terrorism. It's saying that he was trying to terrorize corporate America and all of Americans and the government to change their policy, that his purpose was to strike terror and fear in the hearts of people who were involved in the healthcare industry. That's the terror argument. The problem is that, you know, he was very specific in his backpack. Right. You know, he was very clear. He did not seem that he had any mental impairment. And he seemed to be specifically driven towards this particular person and not just the healthcare industry broadly.
Last thing for you before we say goodbye, Thane. Today, President Biden commuted the sentences of 37 death row inmates, federal death row inmates. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, the interesting question is the three that he didn't, right? He had 30 on his plate. He commuted 27 and didn't on the three. And the question is, what was, you know, the three must have been what's called the worst of the worst, the ones that he couldn't live with.
Yeah, it was Dylan Roof and Dzhokhar Tsarnaev of the Boston Bomber. I mean, guys like that. Yeah,
There you go. See, the world, the Americans would go insane. The people from Boston who lost their legs in the Boston Marathon would go in. They would understandably go insane. Look, you know, the pardon power is unlimited as long as it's federal nature. I look at this as an example of Joe Biden's, you know, an endless connection with the progressive minds of the Democratic Party. And I think this is the kind of thing that appeals, you know, to say, look, we're taking you off death row. If we can avoid having you, you're still going to spend the rest of your life in jail. But we're sending a progressive message that we're opposed to the death penalty under the Eighth Amendment.
Thane Rosenbaum, CBS legal analyst, appreciate your time as always. Thank you.
Anytime. Thank you.
Yep. So those 37 people that he commuted, they're still going to be in prison. They're not let out of prison. But the three people he did not were the Tree of Life synagogue shooter, the Black Church in South Carolina, that shooter, and then the Boston bomber. So those were the three people who did not. So 37 others were commuted. That's Amy Marks Kors. I'm Chris Ranji. Again, we are going to talk with Melissa Lockard, who covered the Oakland A's, no longer the Oakland A's, for The Athletic. Ricky Henderson, one of baseball's greats, passing away yesterday. That interview coming up at the bottom of the hour. But we want to hear from you still with the Odyssey app. Leave us a voice message. It's Chris and Amy on KMOX.
This was the Christmas song. We had this on vinyl, and we also had it on cassette tape. And we would sit in our station wagon and drive to Grandma and Grandpa's house and listen to Michael W. Smith sing the song. Angels we have heard
on high. Oh.
I think it's 78 stinks. Or 80.
80 it, what?
Like, I think that's when it was made. Because Amy Grant, her Tennessee Christmas, I think was 1978. And we had that on vinyl. And, Amy Grant and Michael W. Smith are my favorites.
Yeah.
Mm. Ugh. Mason Jar, not a big fan of that song.
Yeah, that one stinks. Mason's
we were,
got
like,
it.
Going
He's
back and forth on Christmas music. He's like, this one.
That's one of the best.
Thank you, Matt. It's so good.
Remember how we told you to leave a voice message
yeah,
on the Odyssey
me?
App?
You told me to?
Well, I told them, the people that we're talking to.
Yeah.
This is how you do it. Terry, show them.
When our kids were little, my husband was a mall Santa. He was unemployed for a short amount of time, and he needed a job. So the children didn't know about it at the time. When they got older, after college, we were talking about silly things your dad did when he was unemployed, and that came up, and they didn't believe me.
That's incredible.
That would be a good job
you,
if you've got nothing else to do in the moment. That's what she said. He was unemployed
for a
short.
I know, it's just funny the way you phrase it.
I
That's
didn't mean
a great
it like
job
that.
If you have nothing else to do.
Or you just really like being Santa Claus.
I think it would be fun.
Thank you, Terry, for sending a voice message in.
She left a great message.
Right. Maybe we should have done that this holiday season. You and I should have been a Mr. and Mrs. Claus somewhere in a mall.
Mm-hmm. That actually would have been perfect.
Dude.
Why do we always think of these things too late?
I don't know. I blame Pajeski for it. I could be an elf.
You're a creative director. Why didn't you direct some creativity before Christmas?
Yeah, what the hell, man? Where's your creativity?
I was too busy crafting Christmas games for you to lose.
You did a great job with the games, except I feel like you rigged them against me.
I think you're just not a real fan
of Christmas.
I'm a huge fan of Christmas.
Hey, Matt.
I live for it.
There are three people in this room. Two of them have watched Christmas in Connecticut with Barbara Stanwyck.
And one has not.
One has not, and that one is Ron.
The same guy who doesn't have a real Christmas tree, who uses LED
fiber
lights,
optics,
whatever those are.
You're the bad guy in the Hallmark movie.
You're Mr. Potter, the Grinch.
Oh, come on,
Ebenezer
Mr.
Scrooge.
Potter.
You
Mr.
are.
Mr. Potter. By the way, the worst person in that movie is Uncle Billy. Yeah. Uncle Billy should have gotten his ass kicked.
He lost the money.
Dude, it's not that hard, man. It's not that difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You got an envelope. Was it $8,000?
I don't know.
Uncle Billy is an absolute liability, and he should have been kicked out of the family.
And since this is Festivus, and we have a lot of problems with you people, not you people, but, you know, Uncle Billy, I've always had a problem with the song I Saw Mama Kissing Santa Claus, because that's a really traumatic thing, because now the little kid thinks that Santa is cheating on Mrs. Claus, and the mom is cheating on the dad. And the kid now has to witness this. Now he's got to decide whose side is he on. Who is he? Is he going to tell dad?
So the child is now complicit in the adultery.
Right. Mm-hmm. Double adultery.
Yeah. You're 6 years old and you see mom making out with Santa. You have to say something.
Because you know.
And if you don't.
Yeah.
If you don't, you should be kicked out of the house.
Listen, Mrs. Claus, I can't believe the predicament that child is in.
It's
a predicament. That's
no, it's not. It's a very easy call. You have to tell dad. And in fact, I bet that originally it was a test for the kid. Mm. I bet dad came up with the test. Let's see how honest my child is. Can I trust my kid to tell me if my wife is stepping out on me?
Well, Santa Claus is that's a tough one.
Matthew, no, you have to. I don't care if you're 6 years old or seven. There's no excuse for not telling dad about what your mom's doing behind his back.
Matthew, do you have a problem with anything on this Festivus?
Oh, nothing that can be said in this room, I don't think. Nothing
you
on the
only
air.
Have vulgar complaints? I don't get it.
Well, what's the big...
No, my complaints are about you people, so I can't say it in front of you.
No, yeah, go ahead, Amy
you
and
can.
Me.
I'm a, yeah, go I'm ahead. Strong.
No.
We're not going to be upset.
No. You guys, you don't match my Christmas cheer, Ron.
You know what? If you don't tell us what your complaints are about us...
He just did.
That was it? that was the complaint?
Yeah.
All right, that's it. On November 1st, the daily beatings of our producer will continue.
Okay. Hey, because it's the end of the year, everyone's getting these wrapped, like Spotify wrapped.
Yeah.
And so these are the songs you listen to. You are top 1% listener of Toto, whatever it may be. But now all these other companies are jumping on the wrapped bandwagon. I got a Starbucks wrapped. Did you?
If I did, I didn't get the notification.
Yes, I got a Starbucks wrapped where it tells me my year in review for Starbucks. And someone talked about how all of this wrapped nonsense is really just so you can humble brag, like, look how cool I am. Look at the songs I listen to. So Starbucks sent out a year in review, Starbucks Blend year in review. And it's your personalized scrapbook. So my top drinks, my number one top drink was the vanilla sweet cream cold brew.
Mm.
And my second favorite drink was the Pike Place Roast.
Oh, so you just got the regular coffee.
Regular coffee and regular cold brew. The vanilla sweet cream is just the addition. So no lattes or anything like that because those are super easy. They don't have to be prepared. The barista who takes your order...
Yeah.
Is the same barista who pours the coffee. So most of my orders were online. It also said I'm a morning person, that most of my orders were in the morning, which is not a surprise.
Well, let me just say this about the whole wrapped idea or the year in review.
Yeah.
Let me tell you all the things that you have done. I kind of don't need that. I don't need to audit what I've done all year. And I don't need, for example, Google does this thing if you use Google Maps.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think they do it every month. Where they tell you about your timeline. Here are all the places you were. And it's a little off-putting. Like, I get it, the location. It's always following me around.
Yeah,
I know.
Right.
I know that it knows, but I don't like that it knows.
Hey, I didn't get that, and I use Google Maps for
I get
all.
Emails that say, here's your Google timeline for the month, and then you click on it, and it'll show you everywhere you went.
Interesting.
I don't really care for that. And here's another thing it does. When you search a place... You know, Google Macy's or whatever, it will tell you when the search result comes up, it'll say Macy's address, phone number, yada, yada. And then right there, it'll say you visited last month.
Yeah.
I don't know if I like that either.
A little too.
It's a little too invasive.
Yeah. Big brotherish.
And I don't need to know all. Look, I don't need people to remind me of all the stuff I've done. I don't need these apps to do it.
That's what your ex-girlfriends are for.
Oh, bro. Oh, they all have minds like steel traps, every one of them. They only remembered the stuff that I did wrong, which wasn't that much, if we're thinking about it.
I can see how it's lopsided.
Can count on less than one hand.
Less than one hand?
Yeah, less. Two fingers. That's Amy Marks Kors. I'm Chris Ranji. Ricky Henderson, baseball great, passed away yesterday. We are going to talk to somebody who covered the Oakland A's, Melissa Lockard with The Athletic. She will join us next on KMOX.
The A's having come from behind a 1-0 deficit. Ricky goes, a pitch taken, he's going to have it. He does! Ricky Henderson, no contest, steals third base, jerks the bag from its moorings, and holds it aloft. Representing number 939.
And Lou Brock, probably the happiest guy on the field right now. He can finally make his speech, pass over the record to Ricky, and go about his business.
It is the Chris and Amy show on KMOX, and as we have already talked about today, Ricky Henderson, one of Major League Baseball's all-time greats, passed away over the weekend. And we go to the Quiver River Electric guest line today. We bring in Melissa Lockard, who is a staff writer with The Athletic and knows Ricky Henderson, one of her favorite players growing up, but she's with us now on KMOX. Melissa, we appreciate your time today. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for having me on.
So I grew up a Cardinals fan, and I had to admire him from afar. But in a way, when I was a kid, Ricky was one of those players you didn't like because he was always so good. And a lot of times he was good against your teams. What was it like for somebody who covered baseball before even that to be a fan of Ricky Henderson as you were growing up?
Yeah, you know, it was sort of, I had kind of a little bit of a split experience that way, too, because when I was, very little, he was traded to the Yankees. So my first experience of really becoming a baseball fan was that he was this great player that used to play on the A's that is now on the Yankees, and he was so good, and there was always sort of that, oh, man, why'd they let him go kind of thing. And then he comes back in 1989, and just the sort of returning hero element of that whole thing. I actually went to the game that was his first game back. And he was wearing 22, I think, at the time, because he couldn't get his number back for a couple more days. But, just this idea that this person who grew up in this town had been a hero here, had been traded, so you thought that was the end of the story, and then he came back. And then not only did he come back, but, you know, he really led that team to the World Series that year. They had so many key injuries that people sort of forget about. Dennis Eckersley missed a lot of time. Jose Canseco missed a lot of time. And he sort of carried that very talented team, you know, to what ended up being the last World Series at Oakland.
Yeah, and Ricky was one of those players that was just, he's the best ever to do it as a leadoff hitter. I'm not sure there's any question about mm-hmm. that. And I grew up admiring Vince Coleman because he was on my team. But even I have to admit that the greatness of Ricky was so far and away better than what just about anybody else ever did at that spot.
Yeah, you know, he was such a dynamic player. I mean, I think, you know, the speed obviously is something that we talk about, but it wasn't just that. It was how smart he was, I think. He really understood how to break down a pitcher, not just at the plate, but also on the bases. He had a real sense for, you know, how to get the best jump, how to get into pitchers' heads so that other hitters behind him would sort of get that advantage because the pitcher just could not pay attention at all to the hitter. He also had power. I mean, it was sort of funny. Like, you don't think about a guy who, you know, he's listed at 5'8", but probably not even close to that tall. He could hit the ball as far as anybody else when he really got into it. But I think also he just exuded this sort of aura that allowed everybody else to kind of sneak up behind him a little bit, right? Like, he could kind of carry a team just from his charisma alone. And I think that was pretty unique in that era. I don't know that, you know, you had a lot of players that could really do that in the way that he did. And so it was just, you know, fun to watch on so many different levels.
Obviously, in St. Louis, like, the Cardinals are king. The Pope can come to town. The Blues can win the Stanley Cup. But if the Cardinals sure. make a trade, that's the number one on the news headlines. Can you put into perspective what Ricky Henderson was to Oakland and how hard it's hitting the people in Oakland now in a year that was already kind of tough for them?
Yeah, you know, I wrote about that actually over the weekend. He's somebody who wasn't just the franchise's greatest player, and he really was, but he was also the city's greatest player. You know, he grew up in Oakland. He went to Oakland Technical High School, was a two-sport star there. And he lived in the city all the way up until his death, and people would run into him all over the place. There was a person I interviewed in my story who met him as a 6-year-old at the Grand Lake Theater when he was buying tickets for everybody in the theater. And there were so many stories of people just running into Ricky Henderson and how kind he was, and how I think he just reveled in being Ricky Henderson. You know, he really loved the fact that, like, he was great and he could make other people feel great by sharing his greatness with them. And I think that's a really unique thing. And it was something that, you know, really brought up the city. It made it feel proud. And it was a shining light for them. So to lose the team and then to lose Ricky is pretty devastating.
Melissa Lockard, who is a senior editor and staff writer for The Athletic, is with us here on KMOX. Ricky Henderson was known for being a big personality. He was very boastful at a time. You know, in the 80s, when he's coming in, there weren't a whole lot of ball players like that. There weren't a whole lot of people who were, you know, I mean, when he broke the stolen base record, he said, "I'm the greatest of all time." Most baseball players didn't do that. That personality didn't go over well with a lot of people outside of Oakland, but it must have been, that must have been something people really liked when he was there.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an authenticity to it. You know, he wasn't pretending to be humble, right? Like, he understood how great he was. He understood that, you know, that there was a reason people would show up to the ballpark to watch him play. And he wasn't going to pretend that, you know, oh, shucks, you know, I'm just some regular guy that's going to play here. He knew how great he was. And, you know, I think there's an authenticity to that that people in the city of Oakland have always sort of valued. You know, I think there's, you know, it's a city and he came from very humble beginnings too, that like people don't get out of that very often, but when they do, it should be celebrated for the effort that it took to get there. And there shouldn't be sort of a false modesty as to how hard it was to get to that point and how great you can be when you're there. So I think people really did revel in that. And I think that, you know, also if you look at the game today, a lot of the things that he did, you know, kind of pale in some of the celebration comparisons to mm-hmm. what we see now. But I think it sort of allowed baseball to be a little more fun and to sort of loosen the collar a little bit. And, you know, I think in our modern, you know, sports landscape where people can express themselves for more, it was important to have someone like him who could sort of say that it's okay to be yourself authentically on the field.
Here's a story I read about him yesterday where, you know, players get the World Series shares and they have the opportunity to vote on whether the lower level staff people who help the team out, like the video coordinators or whatever, get a full playoff share. They can vote on that. And he was always, you know, yeah, like it's $500,000. That's life changing money for somebody else. And some of the other players didn't agree. How many stories like that about him, the generosity that he had that maybe a lot of people didn't know about?
Yeah, I think there's a lot. And it's you know, on both a big scale like that and on a small scale. I mean, if you saw him around the Coliseum, every single staff person that worked there, and a lot of the people that worked at the stadium worked there for 20 or 30 years, he knew them. And he'd come up and he had the same kind of running conversation with each security guard and, you know, ticket usher and, you know, clubhouse guy. He was somebody who, you know, if there was a kid that was brought to the ballpark that was on the field, he'd go over and spend 5 minutes talking to the kids and signing an autograph. You know, as I said, there's that story, he's out and going to the movies and he sees a bunch of kids in the movie theater and he decides to buy them all tickets. Like, I think that was something that he also, you know, part of the sharing of the greatness of Ricky Henderson was sharing himself with everybody else. And so he was, there was not a lot of barrier there. Like, he would talk to anyone. He kind of always had a smile on his face. And, you know, there's also that famous story too of how he'd play left field and he'd have a running conversation with the fans in left field throughout the game, you know, and he'd stop, catch a ball, throw it back, and then continue the conversation like, you know, nothing had ever happened. But, you know, those are the sort of memories that people keep with them for their whole lives, right? When somebody takes 5 seconds out of their life, you know, at the stature of someone like Ricky Henderson to take time with them, and that there's so many people who have those stories, I think is a real treasure.
Yeah, you talk about his different relationships, and just because here in St. Louis, he was good friends with Lou Brock, and you talk about Ricky Henderson's greatness and how Lou Brock recognized that right away, that he said, he's the heir to the record. He's going to take the record from me. Can you expand more on their relationship at all, or at least his relationship with others, other greats?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a lot, I think, was made of when he made that speech, and perhaps it was a little hurtful at the time for Lou Brock. I don't think he meant it as I'm the greatest of all time, like, you know, I'm the greatest person who ever lived. Mm-hmm. I think he meant, like, I just got this record, and that means I'm the greatest stolen base person of all time, which I think was undisputable. But, I think there were some players that bristled to, you know, kind of what he was about at the time. But if you look at all the different teammates that have sort of come out since, he passed away, to talk about how much fun he had, how much of a joy he was to be around in the clubhouse. You know, I think, you know, for all the little stories about, like, you know, there were contract holdouts and there were different things throughout his career, when he was in the clubhouse and when he was playing and when he was with everybody, he wasn't like the mopey guy in the corner who didn't want to do stuff. He was always there. He had the good energy. And he did so much for his team because, you know, if you think of the skill set, he could have been like the number three hitter, home run guy who got a lot of the glory that way. Instead, he was the one who set the table for everybody. And I think that takes a unique personality for anyone to do something like that. But that he chose to go about it that way, I think, you know, was really unique because his skills could have allowed him to be any kind of player, really. So I think, yeah, I mean, I think he's somebody that everybody around the league is going to miss.
There are a bunch of anecdotes about him, like the John Olerud one where he said, I used to play with a guy who wore a helmet on the field, and Olerud said, that was me. There's that one that is probably not true. And then there is was it the 10-year story? Like, someone said, do you have 10-year? He's like, 10-year? Ricky got 15-year. Whatever it is. Like, of all those stories, is there one that you can think of that you know for a fact to be true?
I don't know. I mean, I think the idea that he spoke in the third person, I think, you know, people are, oh, this, he really did, you know.
Yeah.
Ricky spoke about Ricky in the third person, which it was just a kind of a funny quirk that, you know, and I don't know if that was one of those things where he did it for a little while and then realized people sort of started to recognize that he was doing that and just kept doing it for fun, or if, you know, if it was just like ingrained in him. But that one was always just very, very quirky. But, you know, I mean, you know, most of the stories that people talked about then, I was not a journalist at the time, so I couldn't independently verify. But the third person thing was definitely true.
Last thing for you before we let you go. I know that it is. Amy and I, we don't particularly care for John Fisher. We have talked about that a lot and what he did to the Oakland A's and moving the team out of town. How has it been in the aftermath of A's fans knowing that they have lost that team?
Yeah, it's been hard. And I think it's one of those things that, like, it's going to only get harder. I think, you know, we haven't seen them take the field yet in West Sacramento, even though it's coming. So there's sort of that, like, you don't really fully feel it until it fully happens thing. But, you know, it's difficult. It's a divorce that's, you know, in the very early and raw stages of it. It's still hard to believe that, you know, we have two teams that are going to play in minor league ballparks next year in a major league schedule and a major league stadium that's sitting there empty, you know, not being used. It seems absurd, at this point. But, you know, it's a surreal thing. You know, the field is being changed into a soccer pitch at the Coliseum now. It's going to host the Oakland Roots soccer team next year. All the signage outside the stadium that used to say, you know, A's on it is gone. But the ballpark's still there. So it's like there's kind of that you know, you drive by it all the time. You go by it on BART on the way to the airport, whatever. And it's not gone yet. So I don't know if there's maybe always that little bit of lingering hope still that hasn't fully been extinguished, but there's definitely a lot of pain. And I don't know how it's going to feel that, you know, like start of March when the teams are in spring training and it's not the Oakland A's anymore. It's just the Athletics.
Well, it's brutal. And we're sorry about that. But today we appreciate your time and visiting with us and talking about Ricky Henderson, one of baseball's greats. Melissa Lockard, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
It is the Chris and Amy Show on KMOX.
This is Amy Grant, Tennessee Christmas. I remember walking down the stairs and the vinyl would be playing this and there would be a fire. My dad was the only one up, the tree, the Christmas tree, all the presents underneath it. This is niche, but there is at least one other person out there.
You have played now two songs in a row that absolutely stink.
I didn't play them.
It's you've influenced.
It's because Matt gets it. We bonded over Barbara Stanwyck and Christmas in Connecticut.
Right.
I'm going to make up for it with a Song of Oranges in just a second.
Oh, see, now that's what I'm talking about.
Let's
play some good stuff.
All right.
Amy.
Yes.
When it's time and everybody's unwrapping all the stuff, do you have a preference for how it should be done? Do you go one by one? Do you all sit there and you open all of your gifts at once and everybody stares at you? Or do you open one, person next to you opens one, then you just keep moving in a circle?
We're a one by one
family. Or is it a free for all?
No, we are a one by one family because the gift giver is so excited to give the gift and you want everyone to see, like, look what I got, Mom. Matthew?
I agree, Amy.
See? Look at us.
It's got to be a free for all.
Just the two of us.
It's over in 5 minutes.
Only yes, perfect.
No.
Here's the problem with doing.
What do you mean? You're an only child. A free for all and one by one are the same thing for you.
I have other family. You know that when you're sitting around and people have bought you gifts and you've bought them gifts, and you do the one by one thing, it's somebody's inevitably going to be unhappy about the reaction they get.
I don't think so.
Yeah. Someone's going to be pissed.
I think
someone's going to say, you know what? You didn't react in a positive way when you opened my gift, but then this one, you're like, wow, this is such a great gift. So, wow, thank you so much. I love you, Uncle Ted.
Uh-huh.
But then, you know, Aunt Jenny comes up with a really stupid gift. You go, oh, thanks, Jenny. I appreciate it. See, I think it just does nothing but cause stress and problems. It should be a free-for-all. Nobody looks at anybody when it's all over.
Yeah.
You're done. You throw the paper away. Have a great day.
Isn't he a surprisingly grinchy for a guy who claims to love Christmas?
What's grinchy about it?
You're supposed to savor Christmas morning. And the giver of the gift is so excited to see the receiver of the gift open the gift that if it's a free-for-all, you miss all of the moments.
Until you don't react in a way they think is good enough.
Maybe you aren't very good at giving gifts. Maybe it's more of a you problem.
Well, that is a problem for me.
Yeah, I could see that.
I like to give gifts, but I don't know what most people want. There are certain family members that are just very difficult to buy for. There are others that are super easy, but most of them are difficult.
Is Pam hard to buy for?
Yes.
Pam.
She is the worst.
We're friends and Ron's just
she is the
not
worst.
Like it.
Yeah. You stop texting my mother. All right.
Hey, real quick, we have a text. Your little producer guy is kind of amazing.
The little producer guy?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if I like little producer guy, but...
Who the hell said that?
I like the amazing
part. Our good friend Neil Salzik of the Mighty
Pines. Oh, Neil Salzik? Did he say, hey, that pipsqueak's not bad?
Hey, speaking of pipsqueak, I got your next song ready.
Yes! The worst Christmas song in history. All right, I guess that means it's time for us to go. Hancock and Kelly are coming up next. They are in for the Dave Glover Show. Anything you missed is on the Audacy app, AUDACY. Download and listen. I'll be back with you tomorrow with Brad Young. Amy is out for the rest of the week. Have a good Christmas, Amy. I will see you next week, probably.
You won't, because you'll be out.
That's right. I will be.
Merry Christmas, Ronj.
Merry Christmas, Amy Marks Kors. All right. Hancock, for you too, Matt.
Oh, Merry Christmas.
Forgot
Matt
about
Pajeski.
You, Matt Pajeski.
Little producer guy.
Little producer guy.
Hey, Merry Christmas to you, you pipsqueak. Chris and Amy show on KMOX. And I live inside your house. And I bring good cheer every year. I am the Christmas
mouse. And I thought, oh my gosh, I live in an apartment. Where do I throw away a Christmas tree? So I dragged it onto the fire escape where it remained for 14 months.
That's not what you're supposed to do.
I know. I think that's a fire hazard.
It is.
But I
So you made the fire escape a fire hazard.
Yeah.